Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Christopher Beal, and I'm quite literally out in the bay for this episode, walking through San Francisco's historic gay neighborhood, the Castro.
Castro Station.
You know, there are other parts of the city with rich queer histories as well, like Soma and Polk Street and the Tenderloin, but the Castro's history as an LGBTQIA hub started back in the 1940s. That's when the U.S. military discharged thousands of men for their sexuality, and many of those men settled here in San Francisco. In the 1950s, white flight saw families flee the city to the suburbs, and by the 1960s, the LGBTQIA community had purchased a lot of that abandoned real estate, and the neighborhood became a hub for the gay community. In the 1970s, the Castro's most famous resident entered the picture, and he lived right up here on Castro Street. I'm, of course, talking about Harvey Milk. He was the first openly gay elected official in California, and he served on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. He was ultimately assassinated at San Francisco City Hall. The very first episode of Out in the Bay, all the way back in 2004, started right here on this spot. Eric Jansen introduces us to Trevor Haley, who picks up the story at Milk's assassination. Please note that this contains graphic descriptions of violence right at the beginning.
1978, November of 78. He shot him in the chest, and when they fell, he pumped bullets into their heads. The last one for Harvey was inches from his head. There were no open caskets for those guys. They were blown to smithereens.
I think it's a very profound place to end the tour, because I really do think in many ways Harvey Milk is our Martin Luther King, and that he was an individual that could take an oppressed group of people, get that bunch organized, and have them believing in themselves, and that they could have their fair slice of the pie. And he knew in order to really achieve that, we had to get into office for ourselves. But he also knew that if he was successful with this endeavor, he had put his life on the line, because he was getting hate mail, threatening phone calls, but he pushed ahead. And so sure enough, basically he gave his life to turn the course of gay history around, just like Martin Luther King wound up giving his life to turn the course of African American history around.
What are the things that people on your tours comment on or seem the most surprised about when you tell them about the history of this neighborhood and the history of gay people in San Francisco?
Well, I think one thing is that people are really, particularly people from the alternate lifestyle is what I call them, how contemporary our history is and what a short period of time ago that we were illegal and arrested, and that at one time we were wards of mental health. And I think all of those things people are genuinely surprised at, because, you know, they happened before their time, or they weren't a gay or lesbian person themselves, so they just had no knowledge of that being part of life.
How did San Francisco come to be a gay mecca that it sort of is looked at today?
Well, you know, cities just like people have a personality, and San Francisco's personality is what made it possible. And that personality was formed in the first 6 years of its life, which was the gold rush. That was predominantly an all-male migration, and people came from all over the world to stake their gold claim. But they were between 15 and 25 years old. The age span ended at 47. So also
we're talking young and horny.
We are talking young and horny. And you see, that was it. That here, with an all-male population, society gives men a whole different set of rules if there are no women and children around. Same-sex behavior was tolerated, if for no other reason, out of necessity. And once something gets woven into a fabric, it's pretty hard to get it back out, isn't it? But also, these young men were the entrepreneurs of the day. They were the risk takers, the fortune seekers, men looking for a new, different, better, and freer life. So they also brought along an incredible element of class.
Since the gold rush, what happened since then?
Oh, many things, actually, that were just simply sociological shifts taking place in the country. And, well, no, the first one wasn't a sociological shift in the country, but the 1906 earthquake. You see, since San Francisco was so liberal because of being a predominantly male population in the beginning, the conservatives came a little bit later to open the banks and the businesses. But the earthquake, they saw as God's punishment because of the loose behavior here. because this was a wide open town.
So it went way back. This reputation San Francisco's had went way back.
Oh, absolutely, to the very beginning. So sure enough, the conservatives had their day in the sun with the earthquake. And they could say to the rest, we told y'all so, and if you don't clean up your act, God's going to sink this city into the sea. So San Francisco got religion over that earthquake, but it didn't last long. We were back on our feet in 2 years, and everybody drifted back. But the earthquake, they had to do something with all the rubble, so they threw it out there in the bay, and it formed the flat area that later became the port. Because after the Panama Canal opened up, we became a port city, the busiest on the West Coast. Now, just like we looked at gold miners, want to take a look at sailors, young men waking up in a small town, knowing they didn't fit, wanted to see exotic ports in the world. How'd you do that? But by water. So they became sailors. So we're Port City. Our first drag bar opened up in 1908, right down there around the Ferry Building. So you see, those guys found a vocabulary to go with a secret in their soul they might otherwise have carried to their grave.
Okay. So people talk about World War II being a big part of it. But
absolutely.
I mean, how does that compare? It sounds like it was already pretty well established.
It was already established, but again, in much smaller numbers. Because, you know, you only had so many gold miners and only so many sailors. But World War II, practically every available man in the country was going overseas, particularly young and horny men were going overseas. Now, the war was in the Atlantic and the Pacific. To get to the Pacific, you had to go to San Francisco to get there. So you see, all these men came, and now we had men and we had both gay and lesbian bars. So again, a lot of people from Idaho or Montana found a vocabulary to let them know that they weren't the only gay or lesbian person in the world.
So how did the lesbian part of it start? Because you mentioned all these things that were these male occupations with young guys.
Right. Well, the lesbian part actually started with passing women. Is that a term you're familiar with?
No, tell me about it.
You know, see, women had so few options in life. About the time men became sailors because they need to get out of those small towns. Well, women could only be a wife, a mother, an old maid, school teacher, a nurse, which they had to stay single, a nun, or a prostitute. So women, that none of these options were going to work for them. The only way they could create additional options was to masquerade as a man. And they generally passed until they showed up in the mortuary. So you see, if you were a passing woman, you were a little bit odd. So what better city to come to than San Francisco that was already filled with nuts, fruits, misfits, and bohemians? But also, San Francisco had lots and lots of prostitutes. Did you realize that prostitution, well, of course, it's the oldest profession for women, and we've always had a disproportionate number of lesbians in the field of prostitution. You see, not only did it allow these women to make money at a time women couldn't make a lot of money, but also, you see, they made incredible business women because their emotions weren't involved. So it was fraught with lesbians then and now.
Tell us how this neighborhood came to become a gay neighborhood. You've sort of told us about how the city came to be a gay city. How did the Castro, formerly Eureka Valley, become a gay neighborhood?
Okay. Between the years of 1967 and 72, we had an event here in San Francisco called the Summer of Love. Now, it was not a gay event. It was an everybody event. Pretty much it was the youth of America took all of the social rules, broke them, and set about writing a whole new set. The philosophy of that group was peace, tolerance, love thy brother and thy sister no matter what, and do your own thing. So gays got included, didn't they? All right. Now, when the Summer of Love drew to a close in 72, pretty much the Haight-Ashbury had been trashed. So people needed a new place to go. Gay men, not being able to stand that dishabille any longer, moved over the hill into this neighborhood, which was Eureka Valley, but also affectionately known as Most Holy Redeemer Parish. This was the little Irish-Italian neighborhood, and it was predominantly Catholic. All right? Now, they came because the rent was cheap and there were many vacancies, and the reason that was the case is after World War II, people moved to the suburbs. So all major cities had deserted pockets. So when a handful of gays moved in, the people that were still living here threw up their hands and said, oh my God, there goes the neighborhood. So they began to flee this neighborhood and move to the suburbs. Now, back then, there were three major means of communication: telephone, telegram, or tell a queen. So word spread all over the country about what was happening here in this sleepy little valley, and that is why in 2 years, 20,000 gays moved in between these two hills.
So I get those people who sold their homes early are kicking themselves now, huh?
Oh, don't you know it? Because they sold them for $20,000, $30,000, or $40,000 back then. The property here, the value quintupled in 5 years.
Now, let's look across the street here. Across Market Street and across Castro on the corner is the Twin Peaks Tavern and Bar.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about the history of that place.
Okay. Now, that bar is reputed to be the first gay bar in the world with wall-to-wall windows. Because, you see, gays could not afford to gather where they could be identified. They'd lose their jobs. They'd lose their family. But it was actually opened in 1972 by two lesbians. And people told them they had lost their minds. Gays were not going to sit up in those windows where they could be identified. But they were intuitive enough to know that the time had come. And so sure enough, they opened that in 72, and it is a little bit like kissing the Blarney Stone for gay travelers from all over the world.
You're listening to a special edition of Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Christopher Beale. Did you know that Out in the Bay is a completely listener-supported show? We don't get any support from NPR, from podcast feeds, just from listeners like you. Consider making a donation at outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org.
I stood there on Market Street, June 25th, 1978, looking up at the rainbow flag, blowing like crazy. And I knew right then in that moment, like a bolt of lightning through my skull, that this changed my life forever.
From the entrance of Twin Peaks Tavern, which is still open today, you can see the gigantic rainbow flag just across the street there at Castro and Market. It's sort of a beacon as you come up the hill welcoming you to the neighborhood. And the original rainbow flag is still flying here, even though the official pride flag has evolved a little bit over the years. Some folks want this flag above Harvey Milk Plaza in the Castro updated to the more modern version as well. And there are yet others who want this flag to stay right where it is forever. And that debate continues to this day. The original rainbow flag here in the Castro was created by Gilbert Baker. Marilyn Pittman talked to Gilbert in 2009, and we're going to pick up that interview with Gilbert sharing how he learned to sew.
Well, I'm a big drag queen, and I couldn't afford the clothes I liked, so I had to learn how to sew. So I think I got out of the Army and spent some of my severance pay on a little Kenmore. A friend of mine, you know, sat me down and gave me some basics, and, you know, I haven't stopped for a long time. But, yeah, I love to sew, and I love beautiful clothes. I love the craft that goes into making things with fabric, and it just was a natural thing for me. As I started making drag and costumes for myself and my friends, I got better and better. And then, of course, I did live in San Francisco right then, and so it was the, you know, the epicenter for the West Coast gay scene. And so it was just natural to be involved in the early days of gay protest and gay visibility. And because I knew how to sew, you know, Harvey and my friends would call me up saying, we're going to have a march tomorrow and we need a banner. So I'd push the gowns one way and dig some fabric out of my rag pile and make, you know, gay rights now for a banner. So it really has always been my activism, my craft. And then Harvey had challenged me to come up with a new symbol. He said, we need something besides this pink triangle. The pink triangle had really functioned as the gay symbol for, the generation before me. But it came from such a negative place. And Harvey was like, well, we need a logo. It was the 70s. Everything was going graphic, a little, you know, gizmo that you put on AT&T and Coke. And I was like, I don't know about a logo, but I was pretty sure about a flag, because a flag is about proclaiming power. And I thought, yeah, we're a people. We're more than a nation. We're every nation. We're a tribe of people, and we should have a flag. And so thus the rainbow. The point of the rainbow flag was about sexual liberation in its entirety, and that, you know, there was a stripe for a color for everyone, and that whole power, if you will, of our cumulative human sexuality was something that we should celebrate.
One of the things people have done is put that on their cars, which identifies gay people to other gay people. On the other hand, it has also caused some problems. One woman in Richmond, California, which is part of the Bay Area, had a bunch of gay things on her car and was pulled out of her car and raped by a few men. And it's kind of calling attention
well,
to,
it is.
Hey, I'm a
visibility tool. I mean, that's what the flag is for. You put a rainbow flag on your house. You put a rainbow flag on your car or wear it on your T-shirt to school. The rainbow flag is a direct visibility action that people take all around the world. And when you put a flag on your car, your house, you're saying something. You're doing it. And so that makes you a target. Regrettably. So I hear those stories.
It concerns me because I think people think of it as gay pride. We talk about pride. Sure. They don't necessarily think I am doing something courageous and risky. And I think that there is some courage and risk in it.
Well, it depends on where you are. Sure, it's no big deal to fly a rainbow flag in San Francisco or New York. You put a rainbow flag up in, you know, Oklahoma, that's a different world. You know, you put a rainbow flag up in Iran, they'll kill you.
You talk about peace and love,
yeah.
Sort of in the same breath as the rainbow flag. I know you are a big hippie, but you also were in the service during the Vietnam era. You were in the Army from 1970 to 72. You were a nurse in San Francisco. You treated soldiers from the Vietnam War. Is that what changed you? What was the effect of that on your life?
Profound, actually. I grew up in Kansas. I'm a Midwest boy. I grew up. I got drafted on my 19th birthday and ended up in the Army, immediately singled out because I was so gay. I was screaming. You think I'm butch now. I was screaming then. And so I was singled out for a lot of abuse. And
But they didn't turn you down. I mean,
in those days, as long as you could breathe, they'd take
you. They drafted you.
You know, I remember later I got, finally they didn't know what to do with me. I was too gay. And finally they decided, well, make him a medic, right? Because I didn't want to carry a gun, but I couldn't get out as a conscientious objector. So anyway, later on I ended up being a medic in San Francisco. And yeah, I mean, you know, in those days it was really different. It profoundly changed me in the sense that I really saw up close the human cost of war in the terms of the suffering and death. And terrible things that were happening to people my age coming back, shot up. So it did sort of give me a big eye-opener. At the same time, I was in San Francisco, 1970, which was like, you know, peace capital of the universe. And so I was being exposed to all kinds of radical ideas, you know, coming out of Berkeley and the free speech movement, and began reading more and more, you know, going up to North Beach to hang out in the coffee shops and explore, you know, the wonderful, incredibly rich culture of San Francisco, and in particular its long tradition of tolerance and openness. And so I immediately felt at home there and began to feel more of my own power to, you know, do something, to speak up, that I didn't just have to let,
so
I didn't have to accept it.
Those things you saw, the soldiers you treated,
yes,
the effects of war, the horrors of war, fueled your changes and fueled your anger against war, against the war?
Yeah, in particular against the Vietnam War. But at the same time, I was really beginning to become more spiritual and to have a deeper idea about God and, you know, life and you know, taking a lot of acid and, you know, reading a lot, doing a lot of spiritual work.
There's God in acid.
Absolutely. And that really opened me up to make the changes in my own life. To really accept who I was, finally, as gay, to come out, you know, even though I was in the Army, and to come out, and most specifically to my parents. That was certainly the biggest moment in my life as a gay person, was coming out to my parents. And I think that that's the story that we all share across every generation, across, you know, all the genders, everything. That thing we do, where all of a sudden we know who we are. And once you know who you are and you stop lying about it, it changes you forever, forever. And when you come out, it really does change you. The liberation, and more important than liberation, the feeling of self-power is wondrous. You become a whole person. And for me, that happened, fortunately, fairly early in my life. And I was lucky.
You created a rainbow flag in 2003 that stretched from one end of Key West, Florida, to the other, which meant from the Gulf of Mexico to the Atlantic
Ocean.
Sea to
sea.
What was that like for you?
It was fun. It was the 25th anniversary of the rainbow flag. I wanted to do something really splashy and huge and glamorous. And I had already made a mile-long flag in 1994 for New York for Stonewall's 25th anniversary, and that was a big lot of work. Nothing like that had ever been attempted, a mile-long flag and 10,000 people. I spent $1 million and had to raise all the money, and I did everything. And I made sewed the flag. These hands made it. It was thrilling to do it. You can't imagine.
It's a phenomenal image.
Yeah, it's a feat. And what's so great about it is that you put all of this amazing amount of labor and love into something, and then it really only comes to life when the people have it in their hands, and when the 10,000 people or 5,000 in Key West are holding it and playing with it and loving it and being part of it. That's when it really has the moment of life. When Key West came around to me, they were like this little town. I knew they had a long history, rather like San Francisco, of being like a place of tolerance and hip gay. And I was like, I don't know, small town, And then what sold it to me was their motto is one human family. And I love that. I love that. Key West. So when I heard that, I went, okay, I'm there. And then it was really hard, People are like, oh, why are you doing it down there? You should be making money in Los Angeles. And you're really, really putting the pressure on to, like, what are you thinking? But I was really proud of that effort. And I was really glad I did do it in the South. Because I think that it really gave those people a great boost of energy. And they, they loved it. And then, of course, I cut it up and sent it to 200 cities afterwards. So, pieces of it all around the world. So.
How do you deal with those critics, the people that want to, what's so hard about that? Or why don't you do this? You're a high-profile guy. You're Gilbert Baker. You invented the rainbow flag.
I get by critics. I've been doing this a long time. I think it hurt earlier. Now I'm a little more steeled to criticism. But actually, I find it challenging. A good critic is a good thing. And a friend of mine, Mary Jo Ferran, made this wonderful documentary, Key West, a big part of it, called Rainbow Pride. And she called me up. Actually, first she called up all my friends. She called up all my friends and interviewed them. Oh, yes. And then she called me. And by then I was like, who is this woman? So finally I'm sitting down with her. She's this young dyke, punk rocker from Montreal, safety pins through the leather jacket, the whole thing. And I'm like, oh, my God. And then she starts asking the questions. Boom, boom, boom. This woman is smart. She's read her history. She knows her stuff. And I actually kind of warmed up to thinking, I would like to work on a documentary with you, because you actually have not a kind of Kool-Aid idea about the rainbow. You have questions. And I think that that's really important as an artist, to hear those critics and questions, because it gives you, or at least in me, it gave me a deeper understanding.
Let's talk about the rainbow flag as you designed it. What are some of the significances of the colors and the way you chose those colors?
First of all, the idea of the rainbow. We chose the rainbow because it comes from nature. We come from nature. It's beautiful. It's magical, like us. It's also all of the colors. A rainbow is the spectrum. It's even the colors that we can't see. So there's the idea of things that we can't see, infrared, ultraviolet, and all the wonderful colors in between, the infinite colors, as we are an infinite people, every possible race, mm-hmm. gender, we're everywhere, mm-hmm. we're everyone. So that really fit us. And I think that that's what makes it work, is that it transcends language. It transcends explanation to be something that people just understand viscerally and that they own it. They look at it and they own it.
Are there certain colors you chose that are the ones that are replicated in all the decals we see?
Yeah, I kind of went through two lives. I mean, when I first made it, there were 8 colors, hot pink for sex, of course, red for life, orange for healing, yellow for the sun, green for nature, turquoise for magic, blue for serenity, and purple for the spirit. And I kind of hodgepodge that out of, some color theory and some, Kama Sutra stuff. I was reading all this stuff, and I kind of sort of made my own little thing. 8 colors. There are 8 sexes. There are 8 sexes in genetics, the way that our human chromosomes bond. They're in every cell. There are 8 possibilities between the X's and the Y's. There are 8. So I like that. And a magic number in China. And it's an even number so that I could split the spectrum into hot and to cold colors. It would balance. There are hot colors and cold colors. It was a huge success. The flag goes up. People got it immediately. I stood there on Market Street, June 25th, 1978, looking up at the rainbow flag, blowing like crazy, 30 by 60 feet. I made two of them. And I knew right then in that moment, like a bolt of lightning through my skull, that this changed my life forever, that my life would never be the same, that this was special, that this was going to be something. 5 minutes into it, people are like, make me one. Please make me one. So, of course, right away, I'm making flags going, gosh, this is really great. And a month later, I couldn't even keep up. So I had to get help. I thought, well, I'll go down to the flag factory. So I go down to the Paramount Flag Factory down on South Market and walked in my pink lame skin-tight Fiorucci jeans, platform heels, and a little sort of chartreuse leopard tank top in my hair, I think, was turquoise. It was fabulous in those days. And I said, hi, I'm Gilbert, and I made the gay flag. I have a gay flag here. And they looked at me like, gay flag, huh? What about the American flag? Well, anyway, I persisted. And finally, I got them to agree to help me make rainbow flags. But very quickly on, we exhausted the supply of pink. Gone. Totally. Goodbye. The entire supply of pink nylon. I exhausted it. No flag has pink. I quickly adapted it to six colors that you see everywhere, the six. It's the idea of the rainbow. Fast forward another 20 years at work, 25 years. All of a sudden, we've got every color. We've got digital printing. We've got digital dyeing. Pink, no problem.
And so why were you weren't able to make any money, like to get royalty? You can't make royalties off the rainbow.
No royalties.
But all the money that's been made on the decals and the flags themselves.
An entire industry, sure.
It's a huge industry.
Yeah, Tchotchka 101, yeah.
Tchotchka 101.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, it kind of was a little depressing, you know, to be able to, you know, see my work everywhere, you know. But then I'd be, you know, walking down Castro Street in the cold rain at Christmas time trying to figure out how I'm going to pay my rent and put food on my table and see rainbow dog collars. So there were times when it really did bite, when it was really, you know, what have I done? And as time went on, I began to realize, even though I wasn't afforded royalties, it made me royalty, and it made me have a life I could never have dreamed of. It opened me to understanding my brothers and sisters from around the world in ways I'd never known. So it, even though it didn't come with the riches of money, it certainly came with an incredible spiritual enlightenment.
And you've made speeches all over the world, many events, the 93 March on Washington, the 88 March. You are a prominent figure in the gay rights movement and in gay rights history.
Yeah, whores and politicians, you live old. You get to be old enough, you get respectable, right?
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. You heard pieces of two broadcasts this week, one featuring tour guide Trevor Haley, who passed away in 2007, and another with Gilbert Baker, who made the original Pride flag. He died in 2017. You can find the full versions of those shows on our site, outinthebay.org. Just click favorites there at the top. Our website again is outinthebay.org. That's where you can hear and share our shows with a friend. You can also sign up for our occasional email newsletter so you don't miss any episodes. That's also where you'll find the Out in the Bay podcast. Please also consider making a donation there to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Out in the Bay is a nonprofit independent production, which means we get no financial support from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay every week, not from NPR, not from podcast platforms. We rely on listener support from folks like you. We want to thank Brad Payton and Richard Merck of Silicon Valley for their generous support, and also Cornelia Enders and Bud Dylan of San Francisco. Note that we'll only thank you on air if you say it's okay for us to do so. Also want to thank KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station KSFP 102.5 FM for broadcasting Out in the Bay every week. If you want to join our team, you can email us at outinthebay@yahoo.com to learn more. You can send comments there as well. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. Our executive producer is Eric Jansen. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. I produced this episode and engineered it. I'm Christopher Beale. Until next time, thanks for joining me out in the Bay at outinthebay.org.